Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Friday, 19th of February, 2021. And we're seeing a market that seems to both want to sell off and buy the dips. We've seen this the last couple of sessions. You can see it on slide two. The sell-off yesterday extending all the way to that 21-day moving average, which I personally like to use as sort of a one-month moving average if you think of the number of trading days in a month. And it touched there on the NASDAQ 100 before bouncing fairly strongly into the close. And then we're around flat overnight, some jitters in Asia as well. I'm not sure if it's the rising yield situation. And we've been talking about that an awful lot lately. We've also been talking about our cautious stance. And I'm so happy to have you with us here today, Stein Jakobsen, our Chief Investment Officer. And we mentioned on slide three, a couple things, a couple quotes in yesterday's podcast that we pulled from the FOMC minutes. First was this flat statement that inflation rate over the longer run is primarily determined by monetary policy, which I argued is sort of a sign of Fed hubris, to say the least, and that they are willing to look through all kinds of unique factors in this cycle. You had quite an interesting soliloquy on our internal morning meeting yesterday on the mistake the Fed is making here. I would love if you could sort of paraphrase or repeat your points there on where you see where the cycle is and what the Fed's thinking is and where they might be mistaken and making a policy mistake here.
Thank you, John. At least I'll try. But the main point here being that Federal Reserve, as you indicate by this quote as well, seems to think that they are designing the future inflation through the monetary policy, which of course is not the case. The inflation rate, as we see live and rising right now, of course, is in this case in 2021 driven by supply constraints. So what the Fed effectively is doing is saying that everything that sort of is relevant to inflation is a design, and a design under which Federal Reserve has full control both on how high it will go and when to stop it. And that, of course, is not the history of Federal Reserve. And I know I'm always hard on Fed and other central banks, but they have never predicted anything in their life. I may be a bad predictor, but I tell you what, I'm better than the Federal Reserve. And for the record, anyone is better than the Federal Reserve in terms of predicting anything. And you can only need to go back the last two times the Fed changed their course. In 2018, me and a lot of other people were saying if they're going to hike in December of 2018, it would be one bridge too far, which I think was exactly the wording I used at the time. And despite that, they went ahead and they did the December hike, and they talked about how they got everything under control. Less than 2 months later, they were reversing course. The stock market took a massive puke, and they had to basically do 180 degrees. And similar last year, in the January FOMC, they talked about how they were looking to rein in the quantitative easing. And again, 2 weeks later, they were doing the biggest biggest monetary stimulus ever in history. So Fed's ability to actually call anything is wrong. But I think, if I may just add to that point, I think the mistake a lot of people are doing in the market right now is exactly that they think Fed has everything under control. But let's look at monetary condition, which is really what the Fed always talks about. The monetary condition has four components. They have the stock market, the dollar, the interest rate, and the credit spread, all of which is trading at all-time best ever. So in other words, if there was a sell-off or if there were any incident in the market that sort of pertained to their ability to being able to loosen up the monetary policy, they can't do it simply because they had index 100 in terms of the support they provide. We have the all-time lowest spread in credit. We have a dollar, which has been weakening forever. We have the fact that the overall interest rate, although we've seen some rise recently, is at all-time low. And of course, we have the stock market at all-time high. So ironically, the only way they can really get to improve the monetary condition is to allow the stock market to collapse and then, you know, do something that supports the stock market. So what I'm trying to point out, there is a massive limit to what Fed can do. And maybe my biggest takeaway from Fed Reserve and my biggest advice to anyone is that don't listen to what the Fed is saying, but look at what they are doing. And what they are doing is desperate measures in every sense. And it's always, it's always reactive to what the market does, which sets up this, I guess, is the next question, the overall market condition. And just make sure you understand that Fed will be very late in introducing yield curve control. Fed will be very late in terms of reacting to too high interest rate, simply because the nature they have and the way they operate is with a 2020 rear mirror vision perfection, but they have no, again, ability to predict anything. So if you want to, you know, navigate the market over the next 3 months, you need to look at the forward-looking indicators. Forget what the Federal Reserve are doing until they do step up, until they do either introduce YCC or other measures that is a huge support for the overall monetary condition.
You went through a lot there, and that's a really key point, the last one, and one I also addressed to a degree yesterday, and that, and we've talked about it before, that the scale of Treasury issuance, net Treasury issuance, in other words, how much the Treasury is going to have to issue beyond what the Fed is willing to absorb, is going to ramp up incredibly. And we have maybe in the short run Q2, through Q2 and into Q3, the Treasury able to cover some of that with its massive cash hoard at the Fed. But if the Fed does not do anything, we need to understand, I guess, why yield curve control would be necessary. And that is, and you can see on slide four to a degree with the rising 30-year yield moving above two now. If they don't do that, and the market has to absorb all these treasuries, it's going to crash the markets at some point, is it not?
No, absolutely. The story, the narrative the Fed wants to give us is that everything is under control. But there's a huge mismatch between their own QE program and the net issuance. And that deficit already exists pre the $1.9 or $1.5 trillion they're going to do, and ahead of that $3 trillion, a 10-year deal they want to do on infrastructure. All of this will be financed by the issuance of treasury bills and treasury bonds. And not least, also just remember that the ability of the Federal Reserve to get domestic savers to actually buy this is not there. Right now, the deficit, as it is, runs at two times the personal saving rate in the U.S. So in other words, you need additional external factors like the Bank of Japanese investors, Chinese investors to show up. And considering the amount of rhetoric and noise that the administration is making on potentially making China moving China into a containment policy, not to dissimilar to the one that we saw with Russia during the Cold War, I think it's very unlikely the Chinese will turn up.
And that gives us the key point, which you made, and that you have a chicken and egg problem, that with financial conditions so easy, they don't have the cover to do a yield curve control, even though this very obvious and looming, you know, situation is out there with this treasury issuance. They have to wait for rising yield at some point to crater risk sentiment, and then they can swoop in as they always do with having to deal with the third mandate, which is the stock market having fallen. I guess that's your main point.
Yeah, my main point is that it's actually not a very strong conviction on the stock market, but a very strong conviction on the fact that Fed has created a casino by the condition they've created. So the same monetary condition creates an equal sign to casino-like conditioning, because we do know, as you indicated, the other way around, that if the market falls, the Federal Reserve will have the markets back in terms of turning it up again in order to mitigate some of the negative monetary conditions. So we have a catch-22 or ever-repeating story, which is that the Fed has taken out the left tail, all of the risk to the market, and they've replaced that with now a full employment mandate. And it's important to state, why would you have a full employment mandate at a time where everyone, every technologist, every futurist, everyone who wants to spend more than 2 minutes thinking about the future, do realize that a huge part of the present people being employed will have to be not made redundant, but at least have alternative jobs or other ways of working. So we are pursuing a mandate of full employment at a time where we technology-wise, demographic-wise, would, if we were rational, was starting to redesign society to society where we measure either GDP differently or we look about how we do transfer income, which of course goes to the lower K support of the economy overall. So I think the policy mistake by Fed is very, very clear. And maybe the final point on the policy mistake is the following. So to simplify it, I think the physical world today is too small for the digital and online drive that we see around the world. So you can be the best online provider in the world, have the best platform, but you still very often need to produce the goods. Often that happens in Asia, and very, very often that happens in China. Then you need to put it into a port and put it on a container. Those long haul shipping rates are up 200, 800%. And then you need to take it into your distribution center and do the final mile, which see costs rising between 20 and 20%. So in other words, the push that has only just started in terms of digital and online, plus the income and green transformation, plus the direct transfer of income to the lower K of the K-shaped economy, means that we have a huge amount of consumer spending coming. And on top of that, the transfer of money directly to the consumers means that we have a pent up saving rate of $7.5 trillion in the US economy, which, you know, at least 50% will be released when we come into the vaccine impact becoming less and there's an opening up. So in other words, the Fed is counting on the old measure of velocity of money, but velocity of money is being bypassed simply because governments are printing directly and simply because the way they guaranteed small and medium-sized enterprises means effectively they are printing money directly into the hands of the consumer and the businesses, which means we can have a big surprise on inflation coming from first the supply side, the B2B, but finally to the B2C in terms of the impact on the margins and the cost going up of everything from getting your stuff delivered to actually producing it in, which is dominant in Asia.
Yeah, and that's a key point you make on the lower part of the K in terms of the, especially in terms of the labor market. What we're seeing in recent weeks with these jobless claims in the U.S., just yesterday we saw one printing at 861,000 for the week. That was ridiculously above the well below 800K expected. And the prior week's data was also revived up very heavily. So this indicator essentially not really going in the right direction with a multi-week high. Of course, we have to hope those jobs come back on board post-pandemic. But the point is that a lot of these jobs may be made redundant in the long term because of technology, et cetera. And that's, so, of course, bolsters your argument for all of this need to have UBI support, et cetera. But also, as we look at market, what the market is trying to express here, we've noted a lot the rising yields. And then we seem to have actually real inflation beginning to rise slightly here, which is a real concern for something like gold. And you've been saying that gold is one of your key indicators. You know, if we're all talking about inflation, shouldn't gold be doing better, et cetera, et cetera? Take us through what you think, why you think gold is struggling here close to support and why you consider it such an important indicator.
It's mainly because gold has a very high risk sensitivity. So if you square off or doing a regression analysis of what drives the price of gold, you will find it's a combination of real rates and the dollar strength. And as we have seen that real rates have stopped going down, so in other words, the fixed income market has sold off more than the inflation expectation has risen, we've seen that gold has been unable to make new highs. What is really remarkable, even in a medium term, is that gold made a high in August and ever since has been in a downtrend. But right now, and the point I'm making is it's mostly technical in the sense that if we give way for the 1764, 1760 level on a closing basis, then we are into a free fall that could see, as Ole has indicated, the 50% retracement coming into play and ultimately creating some havoc in that market in itself at a time where iron ore, the industrial metals overall, copper is making all-time 10-year and 15-year high. There is a dispersion, there is a divergence between those two markets. And I put that all down to the fact that it's more rate sensitive and it is a store of value. Unlike the industrial metal, which of course can be applied into the whole green transformation story and the lack of supply that's going on. That is not the case in gold. And gold has also, to some extent, and I have to be careful using these words, but primitively, everyone thinks that gold is always the best port for when you are wanting to deal with inflation risk. It is, but it's only that when it's, as always keep indicating, if it's based on the fact that you see inflation rising far faster than the interest rate. what I'm saying is I think it's a combination of both. I think the underlying industrial metal and then supply constraints in the market will make sure that we have inflationary pressure. But I think the realization of those inflation impacts into both the actual numbers that monitors it and the consumers being hit by it will be 3 to 4 months delayed. Meanwhile, the immediate impact is that the part of the regression which goes to the interest rate side and the dollar side is moving against gold, and as such indicating that this is not a broad-based inflationary story. It's a combination of the marginal cost of capital going up at a time where you also have inflationary pressure, which of course will lead to the very interesting story that you have to predict that there will be stagflation in certain parts of the economy and there will be inflation in other parts of the economy at the same time. And then you have to weight that by, you know, a matrix of how big are these sectors relative to the economy. The good thing, I guess, for the market right now is that the mining and energy complex is less than 10% of the S&P 500. But ultimately, you know, that is the real world, and that real world will spill into the ability of platforms like Google's and Amazon and others to maintain their margins. So it's going to be an interesting story, but one where the timeline is and the focus is on the rising interest rate or inflation in the short term.
Right. And speaking of rising interest rates, you can see on slide six, where we're looking at dollar yen. We've talked a lot about the yen sensitivity to the rise in U.S. yields, and we saw it squeeze higher, taking out the 200-day moving average, and it sort of edged back down towards there. So really curious to see how that shapes up. If we get a reversal there, which would indicate to me that the market sees that yields can rise elsewhere as well, and that the U.S. inflation and real interest rates picture will be deteriorating relative to other countries. And you can see on the left there a small inset of Bloomberg chart showing the 20-year JGB yield, so Japanese government bond yield, hitting new highs not seen since the very end of 2018, currently around 50 basis points. So some Japanese yields can go somewhat positive even there. And even to a degree in Europe, we're seeing yields picking up. I saw this morning the French 10-year sits around negative 8 basis points, well off of its lows for the cycle. And then let's look forward to next week on and today, or really on the macro calendar. We've got a number of flash PMIs rolling in this morning from Europe and later from the U.S. Curious to see the Eurozone. We know they're in lockdown. We know we're waiting for the post-vaccine situation there. The U.S. has managed to sort of continue its reasonable expansion, but of course we'll be looking for any changes in velocity. And then next week, a quite busy one on the central bank front with Fed Chair Powell testifying before Congress. And the usual semi-annual testimony there, and then the RBNZ with its rate decision, and always going to be interesting, but especially starting, I would say, with the March data cycle, the U.S. inflation numbers, the latest ones for the PCE, the Fed's key indicator, those are up on Friday. We'll also have our equity strategist, Peter Garner, back online, taking you through all the latest earnings reports and what's going on in the equity market. For today, we thank you for joining, and I'm just happy to have you staying on the program today. Have a great weekend. Stay careful out there, and we will be back next week with the Saxo Market Call.